Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thank you for joining us on Green Sense. We know you have a lot of choices out there, and we're glad you have chosen the place where common sense meets economic sense to make Green Sense. Bob Kessler is our executive producer. He's going to tell us more about who we're going to meet and what we're going to learn on this week's show.
Robert, we are on the cusp, or perhaps already in what I've heard you refer to as the Green Rush. So somebody who's a real pioneer in that particular rush is going to join us and tell us more about just what the Green Rush is all about.
Green Rush. Can that be money? Can that be
algae?
Algae, or can it be hemp? We'll find out more on this week's edition of Green Sense. The passage of the 2018 Farm Bill has made hemp production federally legal, creating the Green Rush, an opportunity last seen at the end of Prohibition. Hemp is a form of cannabis that is high in CBD and low in THC, and it's used to produce grain, industrial fiber, and CBD oil. Cannabis grown for marijuana is high in THC and low in CBD, and it's used for recreational and medicinal purposes and is illegal to grow federally, but many states have made it legal. The legalization of cannabis has created great opportunities for farmers, processors, and entrepreneurs. It's also created challenges for law enforcement, banking, and companies who have to update policies to address a society where cannabis is now legal. We're lucky to have Bob Crumley. He is an early adopter and a pioneer in the hemp industry, and he's also the founder of Founders Hemp. They're one of the first vertically integrated hemp companies out of North Carolina, and he joins us on Green Sense to help clarify and tell us more about the market. Bob, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks, Robert. Happy to be here.
Bob, you were a very successful personal injury trial lawyer. You sold your business, started another one. What got you into the hemp business? And why are you so interested about it?
Sure. But I had three friends die of cancer, and I began looking for things, not necessarily that might cure cancer, but could help through the process, because it's a pretty ugly process. And that led me to cannabis. I was concerned about some of the marijuana issues. At the same time, Mitch McConnell was pushing through the 2014 Farm Bill, which created hemp as a pilot program. And I said, that's it. That's what we can do. And so I became instrumental in helping North Carolina get their bill introduced and passed, as well as setting up the North Carolina Industrial Hemp Association.
Bob, tell us briefly, what's the difference between marijuana and hemp?
Well, the real difference is the THC level. Marijuana didn't really exist in the world the way we know it today until the 1840s. It was created by farmers in Mexico. And it's kind of like breeding a yellow rose into a red rose, or a red rose into a yellow rose or something. I mean, it's taken a plant that historically for thousands of years was low THC, and those farmers started breeding it to create the THC level. They found out when they ingested it at higher THC levels, they got that woo, you know, high effect. And that's really primarily the difference. As you mentioned in your intro, once you increase the THC level, the plant naturally reduces the cannabinoid level of the other cannabinoids, including CBD. And so its overall true holistic medicinal value and benefit, from my perspective, goes down as opposed to staying at that high level when you're just talking about hemp.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the hemp supply chain. And it starts with genetics and getting good seeds that you can create good plants. And then it moves into propagation, growing young plants that can be planted into the field. And then there's your field cultivation and harvesting, drying, processing into the biomass to produce the crude CBD oil, which is then further refined into distillate and isolate to make products for retail sales to the consumer. And this is all moving very fastly as the law just made hemp legal. And each of these different steps requires a high level of expertise and skills. For example, you know, farming in the field is very different than processing the biomass into oil. As a vertically integrated company, how are you able to have so much expertise under one roof to have all these operations?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, vertical integration, some days I laud it and some days I rue the day that we ever did it. Here's the problem. In today, if you don't control your critical source of supply, if you don't have farming as a part of your company, you really are at risk because this is a completely fragmented market. You can't go down to the Chicago Board of Trade and get hemp futures. It doesn't exist yet. And so it's very difficult. You have to hire people in specific roles. We have a director of farm ops that has over 30 years as a farmer. Our director of production is a black belt Six Sigma level person. We have a PhD chemist on staff on our extraction side. So you've got to, for each element of your company, be willing to invest in the types of folks. And I'll tell you, the PhD chemist is a different person than a 30-year farmer, but I certainly could not rely on my chemist to give me farm advice as much as I can't rely on my farmer to give me chemical advice. So you just have to be willing to do what it takes to bring the right people in.
With a new emerging market, is it hard to find talented, skilled people to work in this industry?
Yes, it's extremely hard. Extraction specialists, particularly in our company, we have recruited multiple people from other states. For example, both of our extractors came from the Midwest, West Colorado, Oregon. We just hired a director of quality from a national food company that's moving several states away. The director of our retail stores was actually last employed out in the Midwest. Our chemist, I guess, is the only guy that's really from our area, was working in our area when we hired him. So yeah, we actually have a national search ongoing all the time for quality talent. It is a difficult aspect of this industry.
You've been in it for a while. You've been a pioneer. Mm-hmm. What are some of the misconceptions that you've heard when it comes to hemp?
Well, the biggest misconception is all I got to do is put a few of these plants in the field and go out in 120 days and there'll be buckets of money sitting in the field as manna from heaven. And it is so wrong. This plant requires a lot of work. The extraction process is not simple. It's not easy and it can be dangerous. They're a Gincana. A company out of Kentucky just had a plant explode out in California. So the biggest misconception is this is going to be easy. The money's going to just flow. It's going to be wonderful. We're all going to become millionaires overnight. That's not the case.
When you said a plant explode, you didn't mean a biological plant. You meant a production plant, correct?
A production facility. Yes, a production facility. Not the plant itself.
Well, you can't turn on the radio or TV, Bob, without hearing about the benefits of CBD oil. But there's not a lot of science backing up these claims. Why is hemp with high percentages of CBD good for you?
Well, let's first talk about why there's not a lot of studies yet. And there are studies being done. For example, some of our products are being used right now by three different veterinary colleges testing some of our products in the veterinary world. The reason that there's not a lot of research done in the United States up to this point in time, because it was illegal under federal law to do that research, unless the DEA gave you a permit, and they have issued zero permits up until recently to do the kind of research. So that's why we're behind on the research side. A lot of great research out in Israel and some of the other countries around the world, but not a lot in the U.S. Hemp's been around for 3,000 years. It's been used medicinally. Well, today we would call it probably more of a nutritional supplement as opposed to medicinal with our current definition of what medicine is. But it's been used for thousands of years. And, you know, we've got medical doctors that are cancer medical doctors sending people to us for smokable hemp to help with their nausea and their anxiety. We've had medical doctors send people to us for folks to get relief from inflammation and also for pain relief. So anecdotally, while we cannot, under the federal law, state that our product diagnoses, treats, cures, or prevents any disease, I will tell you, there are a lot of people in the United States anecdotally getting a lot of good results. The studies will come later, and I believe they will verify what people are anecdotally saying.
Well, one of the big challenges out there is the legal definition of hemp and marijuana. Hemp is cannabis. Both hemp and marijuana come from the same genus. That's cannabis, and the species vary. There's three of them, indica, sativa, and ruderalis. CBD hemp, as we mentioned, has high CBD and it's less than 0.3% THC. As we mentioned, cannabis, marijuana is anything above that legally by definition. So this creates big challenges for law enforcement when they stop people working in the hemp business, making deliveries, or people who have hemp. So how does law enforcement differentiate in the field between cannabis and hemp?
Well, let me start with a little bit different twist on that question. The first thing we have to have is we have to have law enforcement willing to make that distinction and willing to educate themselves. In North Carolina, I've educated law enforcement, Sheriff's Department, Police Department, the North Carolina Police Chiefs Association, all over North Carolina. And there are law enforcement officers and departments that want to be educated and want to assist farmers to be able to grow this crop. There's others that really choose to remain ignorant about the products and ignorant about hemp. So I think the first thing we have to do is to get the law enforcement on to understand this is a critical crop for farmers in our state of North Carolina. When I co-wrote the statute for North Carolina, we actually put a police chief and a sheriff's position on the North Carolina Hemp Commission so we could get law enforcement directly involved with us. The biggest education issue now with law enforcement, or the lack of education, as you will, would be on the smokable flower position. And we have law enforcement officers who all along the spectrum from we don't care about hemp, we don't, if somebody's got a product marked as hemp, fine, all the way to the position now where there is a significant amount of law enforcement saying we don't care about cannabis, period, unless you've got one recent department I talked to, their position is unless you're caught with 50 pounds or more, we're not even going to test it to see whether it's hemp or marijuana. So that's changing over the country. Just this week, the U.S. Judiciary Committee in the House voted to approve the marijuana legalization bill. As that bill continues to move through Congress, and if it ultimately becomes law and marijuana cannabis is legalized nationwide, law enforcement, of course, will have another big issue to have to deal with.
Well, you mentioned smokable flower, and the difference by sight between hemp smokable flower and cannabis marijuana is very difficult. There really is no difference when you visually look at it. And urban legend says that you can't test it in the field and differentiate it. But you've come up with some ideas on how law enforcement can make tests. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Historically, law enforcement has used what they refer to as look and smell. If they came up to your car and they saw what looked to be marijuana and smelled like cannabis, then they would use that as probable cause to search your car. What we've come to find out is most law enforcement really didn't care whether you had marijuana in the car. They used that as a subterfuge so that they could search the car looking for other stuff like money, other types of drugs. Now they can no longer use the sight and smell because hemp cannabis, as you mentioned, looks and smells exactly like marijuana cannabis. So we're working with a sheriff's department in North Carolina that tested a kit that was used that is used in Europe. It was manufactured in Europe. It's used by three countries in Europe, and they got a hold of those test kits and worked with us. They tested test kits with known quantities of marijuana that they got from a court order to take some marijuana that they had seized. So they had known quantities of marijuana, known quantities of hemp. Tested it, and this test kit proved out 100% of the time. The DEA is also, as we understand it, working on about three different types of roadside test kits to be able to allow law enforcement officers to tell the difference. The problem we have in North Carolina, a lot of our law enforcement officers don't want that test kit. They want smokable flower to be illegal so they can once again use sight and smell as probable cause to search people's cars. Me personally, I don't think that's ever coming back. I think law enforcement's going to have to figure out other ways to get probable cause to search people's cars if that's what they want to do. I think these test kits will be available within the next 6 to 12 months on a wide scale. There are right now some law enforcement agencies in the United States that are using these test kits. I know the state of Virginia recently approved some test kits to be used by their law enforcement.
Bob, this is a fascinating topic, very complex. The legalities of marijuana and hemp make it even more confusing, but there's great opportunities out there. I really appreciate you being on the show. In closing, you're a very successful young man. you've started a number of businesses. You could probably have gone off into retirement, enjoyed yourself hunting, fishing, flying planes, all the good things that retirement brings. And starting a new business can be compared to the Greek mythological character Sisyphus, who was eternally punished, and he had to push a huge stone uphill, only to have it roll down again once it reached the summit. So tell us, what do you like about being an early adopter and a pioneer in the hemp business that makes pushing that rock uphill each day worth it?
It is the anecdotal comments I get from people. When a couple, I was speaking at an event, and they during question and answer, they said, "We started using our product, your product, with our pet. He has grand mal seizures, and we started using that 6 months ago, and he's not had a seizure since." When an undercover vice narcotics officer tells me that his doctor recommended he use our products because he was using so much NSAIDs, Tylenol, that kind of stuff, that his liver enzymes were out of whack, he started using our oil, and within less than 6 months, his liver enzymes were back to normal. When you hear all these anecdotal stories, whether it's kids with ADHD or whether it's cancer patients, and you hear these anecdotal stories, you know you're making a difference. At my age, and I'm not young, I wish I was, I'm 62, but at this age, being a part of an industry that genuinely is helping people, man, that makes all the pushing that stone uphill worth it.
Bob, thanks for joining us on GreenSense, and hopefully one day that stone won't roll down again.
I'm sure it won't. Thanks for having me.
That's Bob Crumley, CEO of Founders Hemp. He's an early adopter and leader in the hemp industry. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is GreenSense. You can subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Produces more plastic waste than ever, adding about 300 million additional tons per year, nearly equivalent to the weight of the entire human population. That's quite amazing. Close to 80% ends up in landfills or the environment. It's time to work on solutions, and Northwestern University just launched a new program on plastics, ecosystems, and public health. We're joined by Dr. Aaron Packman, a professor of civil and environmental engineering with Northwestern, here on GreenSense. Dr. Packman, welcome to GreenSense.
Yeah, thank you very much, Robert.
Much of the program focuses on microplastics. Tell us how those are defined and how ubiquitous they are.
So microplastics are just what they sound like. They're small particles. And actually, there isn't a strict definition. This is because these have recently been studied. They're recently found more or less everywhere from the ocean to the human gut. And there aren't scientific standards on how they're measured. So most people would define them under 5 millimeters or so.
All right. That's exactly what I was going to ask. Thank you.
Yeah.
It seems like microplastics are something we've only heard about recently, but they've been produced for decades. Did it take everybody totally by surprise, or is it something plastic producers have been aware about for years?
The plastic producer side, I don't know, but the point of plastics is you have cheap, lightweight, disposable, long-lived material. So it was clear from the beginning that it would be persistent in natural systems. And if you would think about it at all, you would realize it would eventually end up everywhere.
What is unique and special about the new program on plastics ecosystem and public health over there at Northwestern?
So the Northwestern program on plastics brings together experts from the whole spectrum of dealing with plastics, from chemists who formulate plastics to manufacturers to environmental scientists and engineers, ecologists and public health experts. So we've never really had this suite of expertise together to deal with plastics from the formulation to the final fate.
And how did that end up in the civil engineering department?
Well, Northwestern is a somewhat unusual institution, and all of the departments in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences are very broad. So we have a range of people from microbiology to my colleague Chuck Dowding, who works on geotechnical engineering. And it's a natural thing for Northwestern to do because we are very interdisciplinary.
And it's a fantastic university and research institution. Are some of the solutions around making fewer plastic products, or are they making them more biodegradable, or are they both?
In general, both. The specific activity that we're focusing on in this program is to develop better formulations that would have more favorable environmental properties. So really, when plastics were developed, the people that are manufacturing them really didn't incorporate any sense of what would happen to them when they were released into the environment. There are also efforts at Northwestern to find more sustainable building materials and avoid use of materials like plastics.
As I mentioned earlier in the introduction, that 300 million additional tons of plastic enter the ecosystem every year, almost equivalent to the weight of the entire human population. What excites you most about this program and how you're going to solve that issue?
So the specific kind of group we have together, this gives us a chance to do things in a better way going forward. One of the big frustrations being an environmental engineer is that often we deal with problems after they've occurred, after things are widely distributed in the environment, and that is the case with plastics. But the long-term solution is to design for resilience and sustainability up front, and that does require working with the people who are developing these kinds of materials.
Are you getting a lot of cooperation from industry?
There has been a fair amount of interest from industry. Yes, I think there's a new generation of people out there, and everyone is more aware that we really need to consider life cycle effects of all the things that we produce and buy. There's obviously a huge amount of public interest, and companies will respond very quickly to consumer pressure. And I do think the companies at this point are interested in trying to find better ways to do things.
You have the cream of the crop of students there at Northwestern. Talk a little bit about the student base and the students that are involved with the research on this project.
So at this point, we've had a lot of workshops that are kind of idea formulation. So it's mainly involved faculty, researchers, people from companies, public health agencies. But we do have a wide range of students who have been working on related projects for a long time. So for example, in my laboratory, we do a lot of work on environmental particle transport in general. So contaminants, natural organic particles, clay and sand particles. So this fits extremely well with ongoing work. My colleagues in areas like polymer chemistry, they've already been working for a number of years to find more sustainable formulations for plastics and rubber. So this is a natural build-off of what all of our good students and faculty are already doing.
Plastics are very cheap, and they're a very useful material because it may be made into so many things, and it's so durable. Do you predict any resistance from the plastic industry in changing these policies and procedures?
Well, there's always a focus on companies doing things in the easiest, cheapest, most saleable way. So in the end, companies will respond to what the public wants. And my real question on this is, are people going to give up the convenience of plastics? I mean, you have a perfect example in bottled water, and everybody now knows that buying bottled water is destructive in a number of ways. But every meeting I go to, I see a big case of bottled water at the back of the room. So we have to wean ourselves off of those kind of very temporary disposable solutions into more permanent ones.
Sounds like a good coalition partner is to have the glass industry involved and go back to using glass for a lot of these. Any thoughts on that?
Well, that one I can't comment on. I will say for myself personally, for water, I'm an expert in water. I use a stainless steel water bottle most of the day. And if I'm drinking water, I'll use a glass bottle. And those are things that, you know, I bought years ago and still use and clean and work perfectly well. So I do think going back to more durable materials is part of the solution.
Institutions and governments like to come up with metrics and specific goals, like reducing carbon emissions to a certain level by a specific date or becoming coal-free by a particular year. Do you have any such goals being set for plastic waste reduction?
Well, I don't see that. Well, maybe waste reduction, but not to quit using plastic. I mean, the bottom line is everybody has to ask themselves, are you willing to give up plastic? Are you willing to stop driving a car? Are you willing to, you know, eat less meat or change your diet in ways that would use less water, have less harmful effects on land and ecosystems? It does really come down in the end to personal choices before you'll get any kind of governmental action.
That's Dr. Aaron Packman, a professor of civil and environmental engineering with Northwestern, talking about the program on plastics, ecosystems, and public health. This is Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.